Thoughts for All Times by Right Reverend Monsignor John S. Vaughan, with a preface by the Right Reverend J.C. Headley, OSB. Nil obstat Gulimus Gildea, imprimatur Herbert Cardinal Vaughan. A preface. The human heart is captivated more readily and more effectually by love than by fear. As children that love their parents serve and obey those parents more cheerfully and willingly than children who are actuated merely by fear, so people in general are drawn to the practice of virtue and attracted to the service of God more efficaciously by the power of love than by the principle of fear. It is true that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, yet it is only the beginning, for love is the completion of wisdom. Perfect charity casteth out fear, because fear hath pain, and he that feareth is not perfected in charity. Many persons find the service of God very hard, and the way of salvation difficult, because they do not love God, and they do not love him because they do not know him. He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is charity. Whoever throws light on this powerful and magnetic principle of love smooths the way of salvation for thousands and becomes a great benefactor of mankind. This the Right Reverend Monsignor Vaughan has done in his excellent work, Thoughts for All Times. From this truly valuable book, the reader gets a deep insight into the meaning of the words of the beloved disciple, "Let us love God, because God first hath loved us." After giving convincing proofs of the intensity of God's love for us, the Right Reverend author beautifully explains the consoling principle of God's personal and concentrated love for each one of us individually. For St. Paul says, "He hath loved me and delivered himself for me." We cannot be said to love a person whom we do not know. On the other hand, our love and esteem for a person grows on acquaintance, increasing accordingly as we discover new excellencies in that person. Our love for God increases in proportion to the growth of our knowledge of God. Monsignor Vaughan is very happy in his exposition of the attributes of God, giving special prominence to God's goodness and mercy. His beautiful and powerful illustrations remind us of the simple yet forcible parables by which the Divine Master so efficaciously detached souls from the fleeting pleasures of the world and inflamed them with ardent desires of attaining the mansions of their Father's house. The Right Reverend author is remarkably ingenious in discovering similitudes between the natural and the supernatural. His mental acquirements are varied as well as profound. Works of this kind, simple, solid, and attractive, are much needed in our day. We wish this most excellent work Godspeed in its great mission of drawing souls to God. We should be glad to see a copy of it in every household in the land. It needs only to be known to have its merits appreciated. We congratulate the publishers of the American edition on their energy and zeal in placing this rich mine of religious thought within the reach of all by publishing it at such unusually low terms. In Thoughts for All Times, the student will find a flood of light illuminating the principles of his theology. The priest and the catechist will find new mines of material, rich in illustration. Parents will find much needed help in the arduous task of detaching the minds of their children from the things of this earth and directing them towards the affairs of heaven. From this book, all will learn more clearly the meaning of the encouraging words of the Apostle. You have not received the spirit of bondage again in fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption of sons, whereby we cry, Abba, Father. Signed, James Cardinal Gibbons. A second preface by Right Reverend J.C. Headley. This is an age when every good and Christian writer who can get himself read, as Carlyle would say, should print and publish as much as he can. For as evil writings do incalculably more harm than evil speech, so good writings are indefinitely more efficacious than mere spoken addresses. Our Holy Father, Pope Leo XIII, has exhorted us to oppose writing to writing, scripta scriptus, to use the press to fight against the press. It is consoling, therefore, to welcome a new book by a writer who can securely count on a large number of readers. Every conscientious and capable writer deserves respect and encouragement. There is so much talk in the world that without the example of those who take pen in hand and put down in order and carefulness what they have vigorously thought out, human speech would before long begin to lose its power of affecting human faculty. There are many, no doubt, who write without publishing. It is to them, especially if they are priests and pastors, that we owe whatever freshness, fullness, and stimulating power there is in the sermons of the present generation. They dig assiduously, and they find treasure. Did they not write, they would be as other men, or preachers, that is to say, empty, dry, and childish, turning the hearts of cultivated men and women against the Word of God, and making solitudes round about the Christian pulpit. To write, if the writer is honest and conscientious, is far from easy work. It is so much easier to talk, in a way, than to search for ideas, to reject what is too common or too obvious, to work out a view, to stick to the point, and to make one's sentences grammatical and shapely. It would be a mistake to call these essays of Monsignor Vaughan by the name of sermons. They have neither the sermon form nor the sermon tone. It is true that the greater part of the book deals with religious subjects. It is true also that in some places the writer takes the opportunity of enforcing a moral point. But they are essays, not sermons. The difference lies chiefly in the attitude of the author. A sermon supposes a preacher, and a preacher is an official personage standing in the sanctuary and clad in ministerial robes. The essayist claims no official position and speaks as one man to another. His audience is not his flock, but individual men and women with faculties that can understand and important interests to think about. There is no reason why such topics as God and God's love, the Blessed Sacrament, and the last things should not be calmly and earnestly discussed without strong appeals to the feelings or that assumption of authority which is so useful and so necessary on fitting occasions. This book contains some 20 papers, most of which have already appeared in print. They are distributed in three divisions and may be said to fall under three heads. First, we have 5 essays on God and the Holy Trinity, the love of God, the nature of God, the wisdom of God make up 3 of the titles found in this first part. Without being abstruse or scholastic, the treatment is solid, interesting, and suggestive. The 2 essays on the Blessed Trinity, first as reflected in man and next as traceable in the irrational creature, are good examples of that kind of apologetic work which does not pretend to be demonstration, but is valuable as showing how the mind might reasonably expect some such stupendous revelation as the Trinity. The 2nd division of the book opens with 2 very interesting disquisitions on the Blessed Sacrament. These are followed by 2 on the subject of purgatory, showing the reasonableness of the Catholic doctrine and the nature of purgatorial suffering. Then we have other 2 on that divine quality and stimulus of the soul, which are called supernatural grace, and the manner in which, through grace, a human being may be united to God. The 3rd division is more miscellaneous. In the riddle of human life, we find a useful exposition of the end and purpose of mortal life. Dust to dust unmistakably indicates a lesson to be learned from death. Man, a microcosm, is a study on the difference between man and the beast, leading up to the consideration of those supernatural motives which man has the power to see, if he will. Pain as a motive explains itself. Heroes, True and False, is an examination of the state of mind which prevents most men from becoming saints. The paper that follows, entitled The Inconsistency of Our Faith and Practice, pursues this subject still further and insists on the view that what is required is not so much to know more than we do know, but, like a St. Francis Borgia contemplating the dead queen, to realize what we know already. Then follow two useful controversial papers on Protestantism. The last essay in the book is on vivisection. It will be evident from this brief enumeration that the contents of this book here offered to the public are largely theological. This is true, but to my mind, nothing is more needed at the present day than to bring theological thought within reach of all who will take an interest in it. It is the fashion in the Protestant countries to pretend to distinguish between theology and religion. There is a distinction, undoubtedly. One is knowledge, the other is spiritual activity. But as spiritual activity is not a mere instinct, like that which makes a bee build its cell, but rests on intelligent spiritual views, you cannot have it without such spiritual views, and these views, which are furnished by the teaching of the faith, are made large, clear, and scientific by theology. For theology is not a mere study. As Lessius so well says in the dedication of his treatise De Summo Bono, theology should make a man not merely learned and an able disputant, but wise, holy, and detached from all things earthly. No one who dwells assiduously in the contemplation of divine things can help feeling their influence in his heart. There may be theological writers who make their theology very dry, but the author of this book seems to have hit what Lessius calls the happy medium, interscholasticum et asceticum, between science and spiritual reading, which is calculated to make everyone who reads these pages a better man in proportion to the growth and development of his knowledge. Knowledge of this kind, whether we call it theology or not, is absolutely essential, not only for priests, but for everyone who pretends to read and reflect. When we think of it, there are very few books in the English tongue which treat theology subjects in a fashion suitable for the general reader, and at the same time, solidly and with authority. Of non-Catholic theological writings, there is an enormous and increasing abundance. Of such theology as they have, Anglicans and dissenters certainly make the most. We have dissertations on God, on the fall, on grace, sin, reconciliation, heaven, hell, and 100 other topics. The theology of these books is naturally of every shade of orthodoxy and heterodoxy, but many of them are written in a popular and taking style and command a very wide circulation. It is certain that many Catholics are attracted by such writings and read them. It is impossible that such reading can but unsettle faith and affect the purity and vigor of Catholic conviction. It is the constant labor and anxiety of priests to prevent the more intelligent members of their flocks from taking up the cheap, well-written, and well-meaning periodicals and volumes which undoubtedly supply a natural and instinctive want in a Christian mind, the want of information about God and the soul, time and eternity, this world and the world to come. The only effective way to cope with such a danger as this is to give our people a sufficient supply of reading of the right sort. Even if there were no competitors in the field, the Catholic flock have a right to the intelligent and attractive exposition of their holy religion, a subject which more than any other lends itself to treatment at once precise and devotional. Precision and orthodoxy are secured by the training of the Catholic priest, who spends many laborious years in acquiring what he puts forth to the public with so much care and persuasiveness. A devotional tone comes naturally to one who writes for the good of immortal souls. If I am not mistaken, there are large numbers of our English, Irish, American, and Australian Catholics who would readily accept any book written with a fair amount of literary power, which will place their religion before them with fullness, with sincerity, with devotional emphasis, and at the same time, in a language that they can understand. Signed, Monsignor J.C. Headley. Chapter 1. Infinite Love. What the sun is in the material order, that love is in the social and moral order. As the sun burnishes the tips of the mountains, lights up the valleys, and converts seas and rivers into liquid gold, making a paradise where but a moment ago all was cheerless and dark, so love casts a charm over the commonest life and infuses warmth and color and beauty and pathos into the most ordinary and humdrum existence. The newly born infant lives, develops, and grows strong as it basks in the sunshine of its mother's love. And even grown-up men and women turn as naturally and as eagerly towards a devoted friend as the sunflower is said to turn towards the sun. Of all topics that can engross the mind, the only one of which men never seem to tire or grow weary is love. It forms the very warp and woof of romance and of story. It is the soul and vivifying principle of poetry and fiction. It is the unfailing inspirer of art and painting and music and song. It creates the valor of the soldier, the daring of the explorer, the plodding perseverance of the scholar, and the unflinching courage of the martyr. Under its influence, the weak become strong, the despondent hopeful, and the niggardly generous. It changes, transforms, and ameliorates whatever it touches, and infuses a nobler and higher impulse wherever its influence penetrates. It is so congenial to man, so completely in accordance with his natural temperament, that he cannot wholly dispense with it, unless indeed by God's grace he rise altogether above nature. If, in sooth, there be in this world one poor sufferer more sure than another of exciting compassion and awaking sympathy, it is the lonely and desolate heart that has no one to befriend it, no one to address it a kind word. What notion, indeed, do we instinctively form of heaven itself but a place of pure, unclouded love? And what is the worst picture we can draw of hell but a place where love is stifled and extinguished and cursed, hate and jealousy hold sway and rule supreme? This would prove a sad and dreary world but for the bright warm sunshine shed by loving hearts. For love illuminates our darkness, it causes the desert itself to blossom as a garden, weaves threads of golden splendor into the dull texture of a cheerless life, and creates a veritable paradise even on the confines of hell. It is sweet to be loved even by the dumb, unconscious beast. The shepherd, tending his flock on the lonely mountainside, finds solace in the friendly whelping of his dog, and the Arab in his tent feels the arid desert less lonesome and the night less drear when the familiar neighing of his tethered steed breaks upon his ear. But higher, by an immeasurable distance, is the joy that kindles at the delicious intercourse of man with man. The doting parent positively beams with happiness when his children press around his knees, the love light gleaming on every feature, and lips all eloquent with endearing words. Yet, greatest of all mere earthly delights is the delight of the bridegroom as he leads his bride triumphantly to the altar to pledge eternal friendship to her in presence of God and of man. Yes, even human love is full of beauty and of gladness. And why? Simply and solely, as it seems to me, because it is a shadow, a poor, unworthy, and feeble shadow, indeed, but yet a real shadow of one of the most tremendous and sublime realities. meaning God's overpowering love to us. If the love that is born of creatures can be so welcome, so cheering, so gladdening, and so soul-inspiring, what are we to say? What indeed can we say of the love of Him who is not a creature at all, however perfect and however exquisite, but the infinite and the uncreated? What is all earthly affection compared with the fierce, consuming fire of divine love burning in the sacred heart of the world's Redeemer? On this earth, we hardly dare expect to gain the affection of anyone much above us in rank or station. A poor, rough peasant scarcely looks for love from a mighty king or emperor. The utmost he dares hope for is compassion, consideration, condescension, and sympathy. Yet God, though infinitely removed above us by nature and essence, deigns to love us in the fullest and truest sense of the term, and in a far more generous measure than any creature ever did or ever can. In plain truth, all love, such as we find among men, is but a dim and uncertain reflection of the insatiable love of the Creator for His creatures. The impassioned sense of tenderness of a fond mother for her only child, or the all-absorbing devotion of the bridegroom for his youthful bride, scarce merits the name of love. Nay, it is, even when purest and deepest and most intense, but the veriest mockery of love, and no love at all, when compared with the love that God bestows even on the least soul in the state of grace. After all, it is clear that man can only love according to the capacity of his nature, and how cramped and straitened that is. God's nature, on the other hand, is infinite and unlimited, and He loves with His whole being. Nor did His love begin in time, nor with the first dawn of our own existence. His love for you and me is like Himself, in this at least, that it is eternal. Throughout the unnumbered past eons and cycles, He not only knew us and contemplated us in His own mind, but He loved us also. In fact, but for His love, we never could have been. It was His love and His love only, and not the thought of any interest or advantage that He could expect to derive from our existence, that determined Him to call us from the hollow womb of nothingness into a state of actual being. Behold, I have loved thee with an everlasting love. Therefore have I drawn thee, taking pity on thee. To anyone who at all realizes the majesty and unapproachable glory of God on the one hand, and the ineffable tenderness and depth of His love on the other, there is something positively intoxicating in the thought. Who would ever fear or doubt or hesitate or despair if he were really and indeed intimately conscious to himself that the loving arms of omnipotence are wound about him all the day long, and that nothing in heaven or on earth can possibly approach to injure or molest him without permission from that divine lover, whose love on the one hand is infinite and whose power on the other hand is commensurate with his love? To be fully sensible of all this is to be calm and happy, and to share in some measure in the felicity of the saints. Sed quis est hic et laudemus eum. There are two wondrous qualities in the love God bears towards men which can never be sufficiently realized, and which we should therefore frequently call to mind and ponder over. Firstly, its intensity, and secondly, its essentially personal character. Like a true warm-hearted lover, he is never weary of expressing his love and, as it were, whispering into our ears fresh assurances of his enduring attachment. At one time, in the most explicit terms, and at others by figures and symbols, he seeks to enforce the same sweet truth upon us and to persuade us more and more fully of the depths of that charity which the Apostle tells us surpasseth all understanding. Fear not, he exclaims, for I have redeemed thee, and called thee by thy name. Thou art mine. I have loved thee with an everlasting love. And in what measure and with what strength? He answers the query himself. As the Father loved me, so have I loved you. And as though mere verbal expressions of his unending love were not sufficient to reveal its depth and extent, he has recourse to images and figures. He represents himself on one occasion as the devoted father of an ungrateful and prodigal son. The son has heartlessly abandoned his father and squandered his time and his fortune, living riotously among strangers in a foreign land. Yet his dissolute life and disgraceful conduct cannot extinguish his father's love. On the contrary, he yearns to welcome him back and to enfold him again in his arms. Each day he ascends the brow of the hill and scans the distant plain to see if he can discern any traces of the well-loved child retracing his steps. At last, after many a fruitless effort, his eyes detect a changed and careworn figure. In spite of rags and tatters and dissolute look and disconsolate condition, the father with unerring instinct recognizes his wayward boy. Yet no thought of anger or reproach enters his heart. No words of rebuke or chiding rise to his lips. His face is not even ruffled by a scowl or a frown. All his just and righteous indignation is overpowered and quenched by the strength and vehemence of his love, which wells up from his heart and stifles every other feeling. At once he hastens to receive him. In his joy and gladness, the father forgets his son's baseness and ingratitude, and all the grief and sorrow and bitterness he has caused, and hurries along to embrace him, and to clasp him with infinite tenderness to his bosom. He clothes him with the finest linen. He puts sandals on his naked feet, decks him out in the best he has, and places the ring upon his finger and the staff in his hand. The fatted calf is killed, the banquet is prepared, the choicest wines flow freely, the whole household is made to share in the general rejoicing, and all feast in happiness and delight, because he that was lost is found. He that was dead has come again to life, and the poor unerring son has returned once more to his father's home. What a beautiful and consoling picture of God's attitudes towards sinful and repentant men. At another time, our Lord represents himself as a shepherd watching over his sheep, gently leading the flock to rich pastures, carefully defending them from prowling wolves and fierce beasts of prey, and going many a weary mile after those that have wandered astray. Or again, he is a good Samaritan, who, finding a poor traveler lying wounded and disabled on the roadside, and robbed and stripped of all his goods and possessions, descends from his own horse and stops to tend and dress his gaping wounds, pouring in oil and wine, places him on his own beast, and lays him in a place of safety. Indeed, our divine master seems to lay all nature under contribution. Even among irrational creatures, he searches for images and types expressive of his solicitude for us. He likens himself now to the hen that gathers her little ones under her wings, now to the pelican that was believed to feed her young with the blood from her own breast, or again to the vine giving life and nourishment to the branches. I am the vine, you are the branches. He is also the tree of life, the light of the world, the bright and morning star, the shadow of the rock, the door of the sheepfold, the head of the body of the church, and, sweetest title of all, the true bridegroom. A chapter might be devoted to the explanation of each one of the names which are applied by the Holy Spirit to God, so pregnant are they with meaning, and so much do they tell us of him whose special name is love. Deus Caritas Est. But true love never rests satisfied with words. It longs to prove itself by deeds and cannot remain inactive. God's love is no exception to this rule. It manifests itself in 10,000 beautiful ways. It meets us at every turn. It overflows upon us from all sorts of unexpected channels and on all sorts of undreamed of occasions. It would be worse than useless to attempt to enumerate a tithe of them here. But we must at least touch upon a few of the most remarkable manifestations of God's goodness towards us. We have already hinted at one, our creation from nothing, a holy, gratuitous act which must be traced back to God's immeasurable love as to its true source and to love alone. But our dependence upon Him does not end there. God not only made us, each moment He preserves us and supports us in life, watches over us as a mother over an only child, and defends us from a thousand evils. All that we have and are effects of His love. Every object whose presence brings joy to us, whose beauty gladdens us, whose friendship cheers and brightens existence, is from Him. All that in any way administers to our bodily comfort or mental content, all that is in any degree pleasant, delightful, and joy-yielding in social intercourse or family life, all, without exception, are tokens and earnests of His undying love. But even this exuberance and generosity could not satisfy the longings of His heart. Indeed, it is the characteristic of excessive love never to admit it has done enough. Thus, having rifled all nature of its treasures to lay them at our feet, having given us the earth for our temporary abode, the sun to illumine and warm us, birds and beasts and every living creature to subserve our interests, fire and water and steam and electricity and all the other powers of nature to labor for our benefit, He wished to do still more. He determined to lift us above nature, yea, as far above nature as the heavens are above the earth. His love induced Him to confer upon us a dignity, a position, and an honor surpassing the uttermost capacities of mere nature. A dignity, in fact, which all the wealth of the material creation put together could never purchase. The dignity conferred by divine grace received in holy baptism. Yes, wonderful to say, by grace we are made participators of the divine nature, adopted sons of God, brothers of Christ Himself, heirs to an imperishable kingdom, and princes of the only royal, truly royal house of the King of Kings, a dignity too great for us in our present state to understand, and which words cannot express, which mind fails to conceive, and which no created intelligence is capable of adequately realizing. To do so would be to measure the measureless, to pour the whole ocean into the hollow of your hand. This is a treasure too priceless to be purchased, too magnificent ever to be really merited, giving us a claim to heaven itself, and to the possession of the infinitely perfect for the whole of eternity. I am thy reward exceeding great. When we have said this, we can say no more. Even a power that is measureless and a wisdom that is limitless can give us nothing greater, nothing more exquisite, nothing more divinely beautiful and precious than the infinite and the eternal. And in possessing Him, we, in the strictest sense of the words, possess all things. Nevertheless, He was still dissatisfied. Love seeks, as far as possible, to put itself on an equality with the beloved. Now God could not make us equal to Himself, since the idea itself involves a contradiction. It was not possible for Him to lift us up to His level and to transform us into gods. But though He could not place us on a level with Himself, He could at least abase Himself and sink to our level. This His infinite love prevailed upon Him to do. He assumed our nature, became a man as truly as we are men, clothed Himself with our infirmities and necessities, and dwelt amongst us as one of ourselves. Nor was this an act of passing condescension. He took upon himself our human nature to retain it. He is still man, verily as truly man as he is truly God. His human body and his human soul are at this very moment rejoicing the blessed in the highest heavens, and never for one instant throughout the endless ages of eternity will he disassociate himself from our manhood. Again and again we hear the mystery of the incarnation spoken of and referred to, but who will give us the power of appreciating all that it means to us men and women of the earth? In associating himself with us in this truly wondrous manner, God exalts the entire race in a degree that cannot be measured. He ennobles, elevates, and honors every single member of the great human family. From the moment in which he was made flesh, he is no longer our creator merely, nor merely our Lord and benefactor, our first beginning and last end, but he has entered into new relations with us and has drawn 10,000 times nearer towards us. He has become our elder brother, our intimate associate, one of our own family, bone of our bone, blood of our blood, and flesh of our flesh. What a ravishing thought that even the least of us can claim a relationship, and such a relationship, with the irresistible and the omnipotent, with him who rides on the wings of the wind, who poises the earth upon three fingers, who holds the oceans in the hollow of his hands, who can do all things whatsoever he pleases, without whose sanction nothing can stir in heaven or on earth, and without whose actual permission and cooperation not a sparrow falls to the ground, nor a dry leaf is swept away by the hurrying storm. Wonderful as this undoubtedly is, it is far more wonderful to note that God not only became man, which might have been accomplished without one pang of suffering, but that he became, like us, a suffering man, a man of sorrows, acquainted with infirmity. His prodigal love moved him to share not our nature only, but our distress and humiliations, our sadness and disappointments, and even our trials and temptations. He made himself subject to fatigue, weariness, languor, and to the pains of hunger, thirst, cold, nakedness, labor, bodily and mental anguish, and finally, death. And such a death, too cruel, too full of bitterness and shame almost to think of, save with tears of sorrow and compassion. Not through any necessity, for is he not Lord and Master of all? But through deliberate choice, out of pure love, in order to cheer us in sorrow, and to infuse strength and courage and a brave hope in our fainting and faltering hearts, and to draw out the sting from our death by dying himself for all. Can love extend further than this? One might think not. But love is so mysterious a power, it is so unlike all else, it possesses such unsuspected resources, it is so strangely inventive. All love will discover ways and means of encompassing its designs, of which nothing but love would so much as dream. Jesus Christ was not content to die and then to depart from our midst forever. I will not leave you orphans. Quite the contrary. He would be more than ever with us after his crucifixion. He would multiply his corporal presence almost indefinitely. Before that awful immolation upon the cross, he was as man in but one place in all the earth. Now, on the contrary, he deigns to dwell in every town and city and hamlet, in the vast metropolis, in the busy hives of industry, in the quiet country village, and in the humblest and remotest places of earth. He holds his court and receives his friends. Wherever there are gathered together a few devout worshippers and a priest to administer to them, there too he is found in their midst. It is the same all over the world. as the express train, panting and throbbing under its hidden fires, hurries us along through France and Germany, Switzerland and the Tyrol, and we snatch hasty glimpses of a Catholic church tower or a cathedral spire, we know that he is there. When tarrying in foreign lands, how often the silvery notes of the Mass or Vesper bells, resounding through some sequestered valley or across the waters of some slumbering lake or inland sea, stealing upon our ears, arrest our wandering thoughts and lead us to muse on the love that has led God to dwell among his chosen ones in every nation. What belated traveler in far-off climes, wending his tortuous way between rocky heights and mountain ranges, has not, while gazing as it seemed almost into the very clouds, beheld the precipitous walls of a convent or monastery, perched upon the summit of some beetling eminence, or clinging like an eagle's nest to the crags and projections of some terrific cliff, and has not thought as he gazed that there too the King of eternal glory dwells under the sacramental species, where men have gone to pass their days in prayer and contemplation far from the maddening, noisy, distracting crowd. But this multiplied presence, this prodigality of love, this desire on the part of our Lord to be wherever a human heart beats or an adoring soul lives, though a most astounding effect of divine charity, is surpassed by the institution of the sacrament of Holy Communion. The great lover of souls would be not only present, not only in the closest proximity, and if we may say so, express it face to face with his chosen ones, but in actual union with each soul his hands have made. As a mother will not merely watch and tend her helpless offspring, but will draw the puny infant to her bosom, and not satisfied with kissing it with the kisses of her mouth, will offer it her breast, and thus incorporate her very substance with the substance of the child, so that it lives and feeds and develops and grows strong on the very flesh of the mother. So does God, the Omnipotent, draw us tenderly to himself, and as it were incorporate himself with our very substance in the Holy Eucharist, in such wise that we live our supernatural life through him, and by him, and on him. My flesh is meat indeed, my blood is drink indeed. Who eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood abideth in me, and I in him. He truly and actually enters our souls,